For more details on upcoming events, follow us on Twitter at carp_lab or check our website for more information about what we have going on. I will let Serge do a more in-depth introduction to our guest today, but we'll be talking with James Jasper, who has recently published a book on public character and the emotions of protest. So I am going to turn it over to them. Enjoy the conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you, Jennifer. So I'm extremely happy and humbled to welcome our distinguished guest who will enlighten us about the issues of public character. James Jasper is a sociologist who has written about culture and politics for several decades, focusing especially on emotions and social movements. His most recent books are Public Characters and Emotions of Protests, which is the edited volume. So in this webinar, he will look at the relationship between character assassination and different characters, their interactions, and by looking at emotional dynamics of reputations. And because James is a sociologist, and we don't really have too many sociologists participating in our webinars, maybe my first question should be about the role of sociologists in understanding such a phenomenon as character assassination, and what can sociology as a field can teach us all about this phenomenon?
Let's start small. I like that. I'll admit I'm not a very well-trained sociologist. So when I started gathering materials for the character book, I was kind of surprised to find that there really was a lot of sociology of reputation and of characters, mostly in the 1960s. So it was sort of the tail end of this structural functional view of the world in which you have a society with a culture with different parts. And so rather than talking about conflict and between different groups, different segments of society, the idea was that we all shared basic values. We all shared a way of understanding the world. And we might have ambivalence built in, share the same ambivalence. So the tendency was to look at leaders, heroes, villains as efforts to express basic values. So the heroes were supposed to embody culture's basic values. A villain was supposed to show the opposite, show what people hated, what was deviant. Victims played a less of a role, but you know, obviously they were still threatened by the villains on some moral value. There were clowns that people talked about. So there was a fair amount of work about the role, the sort of psychological, cultural role of heroes. As some of you may know, one of the drawbacks of this whole paradigm was, as I've mentioned, there was not much room for conflict. There wasn't really room for creativity or change there. So the whole paradigm kind of collapsed. You know, I'm talking about Talcott Parsons and Robert Merton and these fairly well-known at the time sociologists. So culture came to be seen rather differently as a strategic tool potentially that could be used in conflicts by both sides. There came to be more attention to the settings of social conflict, whether class conflict or gender conflict, racial conflict. And so there came to be more of a sense of the institutional constraints, the structural constraints on political players than there had been before. And so culture and conflict kind of went different ways in sociology for a couple decades. And I think they're just now, and I see this as sort of one of the things I've been trying to do, coming back together. So we see more about how culture is used in particular settings, in particular arenas. So I'm very fond, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, of classical rhetoric, which has emotions, has purpose, has a very clear sense of the producer of the messages, the images, speeches, and the audience and the impacts on audiences. So sociology is not entirely to the point where you are yet, but it's getting there. Somebody like Jeff Alexander, for example, sort of belatedly discovered culture a while ago. And he's a good example of somebody who began as a kind of neo-functionalist, recognized the importance of culture, still, I think, has a problem of recognizing the role of culture in conflict. He still has this tendency to think that institutions have their own logics to them and pull people in the public sphere, wants to pull people in, almost has its own volition. So there's, I think sociology has a way to go. And I personally believe that studying rhetoric and communication more is a good direction for us personally.
Thank you, James. So what is your definition of public character, and what exactly did you want to achieve by writing this book?
Well, first of all, I should point out, I think this is one of the differences between my work and character assassination. I don't talk about character. I talk about characters. So unlike you all, where you're talking about moral character, somebody's reputation as a moral person or group's reputation, I'm really talking about specific character tropes. You know, I'm very interested in heroes, villains, victims, and minions. They're actual character constructions. It doesn't have so much to do with character in that nice 19th century sense of the word, you know, he's a fine character or so on, whereas I think character assassination is primarily using that sense of the term. They're closely related, but there's a difference between character and characters. The history of my interest in it came out of my interest in cultural sociology, which went, like every other discipline, went into a kind of narrative turn in the late 1990s. And I have a lot of friends who are narrativists. And I think they really made kind of overblown, overstretched claims about the importance of narrative as being the source of all meaning. And the main thing, it seemed to me at the time, that they left out was what it really is that gives narratives their emotional power. It's not the suspense of the plot. It's not the sequence of actions. It's the human beings, or quasi-human beings, who are the characters in these narratives. And so I guess the mid-90s, I began gathering materials, trying to figure out, well, who are these characters? Why do they matter? And as you know, a lot of narrative theory at the time was based on literature, and literature, kind of ironically, over the course of the 20th century, moved away from what we would call recognizable stock characters and toward much more complex characterizations, personae. But you find what are, in fact, very traditional characters in politics still, you know, as much as ever, I think. So the application of narrative, or the, you know, from literature and the arts to politics didn't work very well to me until we began to recognize the importance of characters. And so that was the impetus behind this book. You know, we always write books or articles about things we don't like or things that puzzle us, I think. So that was the source of it.
Your other line of research has to do with social movements and social protests. So in the field of character assassination, we often discuss protesters, activists, advocates as agents of subversion, right? So we always picture them as attackers who are trying to destroy the reputation of a politician or a corporate CEO, and or they join the chorus around some Twitter hashtag, and they become moral crusaders by blame some individuals for wrongdoings. And it looks like you look at them from a different perspective. Could you please elaborate the way you, maybe how your research in public character and your research in social movements overlap?
Well, I think that's probably why you use field theory in developing character assassination theory, because I think field theory also has this sense, and I won't say it's wrong, but it's a bit jumping ahead a little to assume that the people who are making changes or who want to make changes in a field or an arena have to be those at the bottom. You think of markets, for example. Well, very often it's the most powerful corporation in a field, if we want to call markets a field, that does things that end up disrupting the field. So in my view, players at all levels, with few resources, with more resources, with few social network connections, with few central, with sort of that are peripheral to the field, or ones that are very central to the field, they can all, or they do all do similar kinds of strategic work, including character work. So, you know, the most powerful corporations in the world are constantly building up their character through PR, their reputation. So it's in fact the more powerful players who have more resources for doing character work. And they are certainly not above assassinating others' characters. You think of corporate reactions to whistleblowers, for example. Well, the whistleblower is the one who sort of does the initial character assassination, although that's not quite the right word, but the initial critique of their employer, usually. That employer, whether it's government or corporations, just come down very hard on any whistleblower, and they point, you know, they're mentally unstable, they're disgruntled, they have this whole long list of character assassination techniques that they use on the underlings. So it can go either way, in my view, that we're always working on our own character, we're always working on other people's characters, and that sort of, that includes character assassination, which I believe can go, well, in your handbook, you have plenty of examples of it coming from the top, like Xi in China, you know, getting rid of some of the corrupt generals. It can go down, it can go sideways, and it can go up, like most rhetorical techniques. You can use it for a lot of different purposes.
If you have to name your inspirations as far as scholars or maybe some theories, who would be your top three?
Oh my God. You know, I couldn't really say. You know, I've been at this a long time, so you know, if I would have to think back to graduate school, I think Foucault was a big influence. I was in graduate school in the early.
Well, you know, when they usually talk about the character, they usually mention Erwin Goffman, obviously. When you know, but it looks like your take on this topic is slightly different. So you really dig deep. So you're not just satisfied with Goffman. You mentioned some other influences in your book.
Yeah, although I do use Goffman, I sort of came to him rather late, having been more of a Max Weber type of sociologist, I guess, early on, of course, like everybody, I was a Marxist. And then became more of a Weberian. I have to punt on that one. Let me go back though to mention social movements. I think one of the problems with theories of social movements has been that social theorists, whether it's Turin, whether it's Habermas, Smelser, Parsons, a whole long list of people, if they have a sort of structural vision of society, they have this problem, as I mentioned, of where change comes from. And what they tend to do is to look around and find social movements and say, oh, this is where change comes from. It comes from protesters. It comes from people who are outside the system in some way, who don't share the right values, or who are torn between different roles and values. And so they decide before they study social movements what function the social movement is supposed to have in their broader social theory. And it kind of screws you up for really finding out what protesters themselves wanted. And Turenne's work is notorious for this. He had these wonderful interventions. He learned a lot about social movements, but the crescendo of his interventions was supposed to be, he would present them with his hypothesis about what they were really doing, which was always they were fighting technocracy and there was some big underlying movement. You know, for those of you who know his, or don't know his work, you know, there was supposed to be in post-industrial society some equivalent to the labor movement in industrial society. And this was sort of the new left, new social movements, pro-democracy, anti-bureaucracy, anti-technocracy movements. And they were all one big movement underneath. And so he would present them with this idea at the right moment. And of course, they almost all, you know, some of them were more polite than others, but none of them really agreed with his great hypothesis about their historical significance. So I've been interested in looking at movements from the ground up, from little things up, from individuals and emotions, cultural meanings, and where they go, what gets aggregated together, rather than a top-down vision of this is society, this is the role that social movements have to play.
Well, excellent. So as somebody who studied Max Weber, or at least you mentioned him as one of your influences, so today when some of those big companies, corporations deal with pressure coming from protests and demands coming from social movement leaders, do you think there is more chance for somewhat what we call charismatic leaders to sustain those protests, or those who, what we say, are very kind of boring and has no character whatsoever?
Well, I think with left-leaning movements, there's been a fair amount of accumulated knowledge about the dangers of having charismatic leaders. So one analysis of the 1960s movements was that they kind of exploded because of the leaders got too much attention, the Jerry Rubins, and Abby Hoffmans, and people like that, and they became sort of their own movement, their own kind of self-interested players. So movements on the left really try very hard not to let the cult of leadership get out of control. People on the right, one of the things that I think distinguishes conservatives is that they like strong leaders. People admired Trump, or admire, I'm already jumping the gun, putting it in the past tense. They admire Trump for being strong, and he clearly admires himself for being strong, and he admires dictators around the world. But there is, it goes along with a kind of, you know, what we used to call the authoritarian personality, an analytic tool that fell out of favor, but I think is sort of coming back into favor in psychology a bit. So there's a tolerance for people who run roughshod over the normal liberal democratic rules of how to govern, how to run things, and over democracy.
Okay, so I would like to go back to the topic of your actual presentation and discuss your typology outlined in your public characters book. So there is a first question coming from Jennifer, in fact. She's curious to learn about your minions, villains, clowns, and other characters, plural, that you mentioned. So maybe who are they in the current political society?
Okay, well, let me start by trying to share my screen. Is that working so far? Okay, and let me put this in. I will warn you, I'm terrible with PowerPoint. So, and it's worse here because what I'm gonna give you is a PowerPoint of screenshots of the page proofs of this book, some of them corrected. Some of them not. Let me get back to the and put it in slideshow format, play from start. There we go. Okay. So this is the book. I love the cover because part, one of the points we make in the book is that in the modern world, characters are available. Traditional character tropes are an object of ridicule sometimes and irony, which is clearly going on here. We don't talk about race much in the book. I'm hoping to do another book basically on that. This is what I wanted to show you. This is how we generate the main characters on these two dimensions of strength and morality. Are they good or bad? So we have this generates the heroes, the victims, the villains, and the minions. And we've added some related character tropes here. You'll see judges and donors from traditional Vladimir Prop and others. So this turns out to relate very clearly to a form of social psychology named affect control theory, which argues that basically we respond emotionally to the world and what happens to the world by attributing strength or weakness to people and things, good or bad morality, and we attribute whether they're active or passive, which is another dimension of character that we discuss in the book from time to time, although it's fairly minor. This is really the defining typology of where we have strong versus weak, good versus bad characters. So you also see there are some plots already implied as people move from one cell to the other. The traitor, you know, somebody who starts off as the villain can see the light and become a hero. The traitors move up, or the traitor, somebody who's a hero and becomes a villain, moves down. If they flip sides, converts rather start below and move up. Anyway, I just wanted to get that out there as sort of the main, what defines the characters for us. That didn't fully answer your question. I'm not sure, should I stop sharing at this point? Or you want, let me give you a follow-up on this now that this is up there. Jenny or whoever was
question that was. Jenny, you might want to ask your own question maybe in a sense that you wanted to phrase it.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is helpful in terms of understanding kind of the typology of who the characters are and their strong and weak characters. This is, I think, sort of the crux of what I'm most interested in about this work as it relates to character assassination. But I'm also curious for you to talk a little bit about sort of the characters we see in our current political system. Like, who are, do you think, the heroes and the villains and the clowns and that kind of thing?
Well, okay. So I think one of the interesting things is that in the old view of culture as a shared thing, you had clear villains and heroes. When you recognize that there's conflict, then you recognize, well, one side's hero is the other side's villain and vice versa. So with character assassination, I mean, I think there's been a lot of work on when character assassination fails, for example. But it fails. It fails, and it doesn't fail, right? If you target somebody who's your opponent, people on your side, on your team, it can work quite well for people on the other side, on the target's side, may well rally around the person who's been targeted and say, "This is unfair," and sort of turn the character assassination back on them, saying, you know, this is character assassination. This is an unfair attack. This is bullshit. This person now becomes a victim for them, remaining a villain for the original attackers. So I think the social structure or the strategic structure of who the players and audiences are out there really matters a lot in how whether the character assassination works or not. And I think that's one of the really good things about character assassination work, that it's very clear that there are certain arenas that are targeted where this is operating. There are certain audiences and not elsewhere. And in classic rhetorical theory, I think it's very clear what the intended impact on the audience is or audiences might be. So I like that a lot about character theory, actually.
James, that reminds me actually the typology of reputation by Peter Sandman, who is a well-known scholar in risk and crisis communication. And he basically said that speaking of reputation, you should talk about your good reputation and your bad reputation. So in other words, you can have both. And your bad reputation for someone is a good reputation in a sense. So when crisis happens, you basically have to see how much, you know, good reputation is damaged and how your bad reputation can get worse. So at this point, you can actually take care of both. And that reminds me basically, wouldn't be just very subjective and depends how much symbolic and social capital you have and who is out there to back you up when bad things happen. So, and that goes back to all the discussion of Bourdieu and his capital discussion, right, in the fields.
Although I think there's several different aspects of that. First, you might have the resources to put your characters out there in the media, your assassination attempts. You might have influence that way. And then you do work subsequently, spread it or to defend people who've been attacked. But also in the middle, there's the message itself. And I think social scientists, unlike people in the arts, social scientists tend to downplay that kernel of the embodied message, whether it's a work of a narrative, whether it's an image. And so to me, the lesson, for example, of the George Floyd case is some videos are much more powerful than other videos. It's not the facts of a case, but it's what we actually see. So if you have somebody with a camera who can take a video, okay, you've got to get it out there. You've got to put it on Facebook or wherever. And there's some sort of sociological issues about who spreads it, who sees it, whether it takes off. But the thing itself, the object that embodies that meaning, the symbol, whatever we want to call it, the character there, the trope, matters a lot. And that still eludes sociologists of culture, I think, certainly. And it eludes a lot of disciplines where we talk about, the frame needs to resonate with people. Well, duh, of course it does. What makes a frame resonate? What makes an image resonate? One of the things we tried to do is be very specific about what are the traits, what are the ingredients of powerful images, powerful words, powerful stories. And so these are just a few that we came up with. There's nothing systematic here. It was just kind of off the top of my head. Well, you know, what really matters to people? What suggests a hero? You know, what suggests benevolence? What suggests strength? And I looked through a lot of collections of political posters, but other sources as well, just to come up with this list that we can look for. So I think with character assassination, I think you could go through and you can say, okay, well, this character assassination consisted of images where somebody had, you know, somebody who was sort of cold and pale in the imagery, had a twisted face, a squinty glare and things like this. You could find this. And then, of course, it helps to compare to other images like the hero images. So this is what I think is the real stuff of cultural resonance. And we still don't know very much about it.
Excellent. So I have a question from CARP co-founder Eric Shirayu. Do you think that human beings are pre-wired to reflect the world as divided into two categories, heroes versus villains, just innate Kantian categories? And he had earlier comment whether your term character work can be applied or can be referred to individuals as well. because you used organizations as an example.
Yeah, it's, well, are we hardwired? That's such a, I usually try to avoid that kind of question because, you know, we're hardwired in lots of ways for lots of emotions, but there's such a cultural input. So, you know, with emotions generally, and let me just say, I think that one of the important things about characters is part of the very definition of the character is to tell us what emotion we're supposed to feel toward them. So villains are people we fear, sometimes hate, but we especially are afraid of. Heroes are by definition people we admire. We may not even like them much, but we admire them. We turn to them for protection. We feel safe when they're around. Same with the others. So the emotions are built into them. So with emotions, you can say, well, we're hardwired to feel fear of some kind. And you can trace, psychologists, neurologists have done a good job of tracing a lot of pathways for these various emotions. But in the end, what is going to trigger an emotion is cultural. The ways we display it are going to be cultural. The labels we give to the emotion to our feelings, our sets of feelings, will be culturally influenced. And then that label, if we decide we're angry or if we decide we're afraid, that label itself then feeds back to affect our bodily feelings in a way. So it becomes one more input into what I call another feeling thinking process is what I like to think of them as. So there's always going to be something cultural there. There is this evidence that in-group and out-group is, if it's not hardwired, it's so easy to arouse in people, bring out in people, that it might as well be hardwired. So are heroes and villains part of that? In-group and out-group comes close to heroes and villains. Usually when we have a strong out-group, we tend to treat them as villains. And if we love our own group, we usually think of ourselves kind of as a group as heroes. I think that character tropes can apply both to, especially to individuals, but also to these anthropomorphizing groups or animals. I mean, to talk about God as all powerful is a kind of character projection, character work in a way. So I think the same work can be applied to a pretty wide variety, even like group stereotypes. So for example, racial stereotyping in US history has sort of bounced back and forth between with targeting Black Americans as villains or as minions. So there's a long history of ridicule and contempt and sort of the silly, dancing, skinny Black male figures. But when Black Americans have either slaves revolted or when they organized social movements, began to demand their rights, suddenly they get portrayed as dangerous and as villains. Suddenly they go from being weak and silly to being strong and threatening. I'll just follow up with that. Here's another image from World War II. And I talk about this because I think this is a question for character assassination theorists. There's a dilemma. I mean, I think character assassination tends to focus on the moral dimension rather than the strength dimension of character building. But if you want to attack somebody, do you portray them as very strong and very threatening, you know, an immediate threat? Or do you portray them as weak, silly, not very threatening because they just can't pull it together? So you portray them as a group of ants or a hive of bees that's upset. Before and after Pearl Harbor, there's a big change in the way in which the US media portrayed the Japanese. Before, they had been, they were usually portrayed as a bunch of rodents or insects. There were a lot of them. They weren't very dangerous because you know, they were stereotyped as having poor eyesight and wearing glasses and really incapable of mounting a serious military effort. After Pearl Harbor, when we had to mobilize against them, suddenly you got images where they are suddenly quite threatening, quite strong. So they had to be refigured from minions into villains pretty quickly. Now, you know, that can be done, and minions can be threatening if you put a lot of them together with a villain at the head leading them. They can be kind of overwhelming. But this is, I think, probably, my guess would be, you would see something like this in character assassination efforts, some kind of tension or choices being made between whether they're villains or minions.
Well, thank you. Question from Rod Carvith. Dr. Jesper, are you a sociologist of culture or a cultural sociologist?
That's Jeff Alexander's idea. I'm a cultural sociologist. I think you find culture everywhere. Meaning permeates everything we do, all of our institutions. Sociologists of culture tend to study cultural institutions per se, art and literature. And that used to be the main way that culture was done in sociology. Now it's hard to find a sociologist who really believes that what goes on inside people's heads and how they're acculturated doesn't matter. We've never had rational choice theorists of any great number in sociology. Our structuralists used to be somebody like Chuck Tilley believed his entire life that there was nothing that a sociologist should study that goes on inside somebody's head. If you put it on a piece of paper, maybe get out and march, you know, the external objective embodiments of meanings, maybe you could study, but that anything social psychological, you know, leave that to the psychologists. It doesn't matter to sociology. And these are disciplinary boundaries that I've just never really cared much for, and I don't think they do us much good. And, you know, character assassination is a good example of where you have to do interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary work to understand it, I think. And I think that's true of politics and of protest as well. Why would we stop at some arbitrary boundary and not try to incorporate social psychology into sociology or other disciplines?
Definitely agree. Question from Lindsay Burr. While many of the malevolence trait can be applied to the evil stepmother, many of the strength traits are masculine. Sociologically, how do women navigate embodying or being perceived as hero rather than being relegated to victim, minion, or villain, keeping the cultural context in mind?
Well, I think that's a great question that the women's movement, feminist movement, has had to deal with for 50 years now, longer in a way. I mean, the suffragists as well. So for any oppressed group, they are trampled, repressed more if they show some strength. In women's cases, they're also supposed to be passive. So if women come across as active, that's threatening to masculinists, let's call them. So I think the women's movement has faced a bit of a dilemma. Does it insist that women have all of the capabilities and strengths that would allow them to be heroes according to our traditional definition of heroes, which has a lot to do with masculinity? The sources of strength are, you know, military power, brute physical bodily power, just being assertive. There are a lot of things that are very masculine about heroes. So do you insist that, well, women can be just as tough, as strong, as pushy, as assertive as men, and want all the same things that men do? And, you know, a lot of liberal feminism went this route. Or do you attack the very notion of heroes as it's traditionally, and leaders as they've traditionally been defined, and say, well, no, you can be a leader if you're nurturing and you take care of others. You don't have to have the strength of a traditional sort. And so, a lot of more radical feminists, I think, tried to push that idea. Well, no, let's get, you know, it's not just that we want women to become capitalists or CEOs. We want to change corporate culture. We want to get rid of capitalism so it's not so nasty to other people. So I think gender has played a very big role, does play a big role in character work, continues to, and it's still an issue. You express anger, for example. You know, it's assertive. Heroes express righteous anger and indignation. But, you know, women have been trained historically not to express anger, not to display those kinds of externalizing assertive emotions. So it's still hard for a lot of women, I think, the way they've been raised, to be aggressive, let's call it.
That's a lot of white women messages as well, particularly with American culture. So are there more examples globally of strong women, or does that tend to be in a lot of other settings around the world as well?
Yeah. Well, we don't even have to go around the world. Black women, historically, I think, have been recognized as strong very often, whether it's because of the supposedly absent Black male in Black communities. And they have, I think, often been demonized for asserting themselves, for being strong. Around the world, I would say the way in which women have most often been heroic is by becoming a different kind of hero. We call it in the book, heroes of endurance. So while the traditional masculine hero rides off to war, risks his life, perhaps gets himself killed or maimed, and basically abandons his family, while that's going on, the women stay behind, take care of the children, take care of the sick and elderly and wounded, find food, protect the community. So this protection is a traditional hero thing. You protect the weak, you protect other people. And so it's in lots of parts of the world, for example, with guerrilla warfare and so on, some women have gone out and become warriors. A lot more, though, I think, have stayed home and been heroes with a different kind of strength, the strength of endurance. And so that's one way in which traditional heroes, villains, and traditional characters have changed, or changed in the 20th century, especially the late 20th century. There are all sorts of historical changes in character types. It used to be that both heroes and villains were typically the offspring of a god, often a god coupling with a mortal. So they were sort of had a foot in each world, Jesus Christ being a very prominent example. So as we are in a more secular world, we don't really believe that these half gods, half divine or fully divine creatures are walking around with us. So heroes and villains have both lost some of that strength that they had when we really thought that gods were active among us. So it's easier to dismiss them, ridicule them. It's easier to do character assassination. It's easier to take a hero and puncture the hero's pretenses of strength and morality and to bring them down to earth, make them more human, make them more humble now, I think, than it used to be.
Question from Jennifer, again, other than feminists, are there any examples you can think of groups trying to change their trait we associate with heroes or villains?
Okay, so an example would be the Indian Dalits who are ridiculed, they're minions, basically, in the caste system in India. And so they've done a lot of different things to try to change that. Some of them just try to escape to the cities so that they're no longer, you know, change their names so that it's not obvious what caste they're in. If they can't do that, a couple castes have gone back in history and tried to find a heroic ancestor, somebody who was a god, some incarnation of Vishnu. And so that they have some lineage that makes them prouder, makes them feel stronger. The whole pride shame dynamic, which is studied in a lot of social movements, starting with and especially with LGBTQ movements, is about feeling strength, right? Shame turns you inward. It makes you feel weak. It makes you want to disappear. It makes you passive. Whereas pride, you puff up your chest, you go out and do things, you become more active and feel stronger. So it's crucial, I'm tempted to say, for almost all oppressed groups to do some kind of character work to fight back what is basically character assassination that goes on for decades or hundreds of years or 1,000 years in the case of the Indian caste system. And you've got to get out from under that constant, I mean, it's, you know, at a certain point, it's not even character assassination anymore. It's just common sense that these people are like that. So I think these group stereotypes could be pretty well understood with character theory.
Eric is asking whether there is a different way to label people rather than talking about dichotomous hero villain. Don't you think a society may struggle with defining or labeling a person in a particular way that in reality would deal with the hero villain spectrum?
Sure, absolutely. Most people are not characterized like this. Most people are not made into characters. So most people aren't good or bad particularly, aren't particularly strong or weak, so they would sort of fall in the middle of that 2x2, which is a continuum. I don't mean to dichotomize it overly. So it's only under special circumstances when people pay attention to your character, right? If you enter a public arena, you run for office, or you, as I mentioned before, whistleblowers, if you blow the whistle on your employers, then suddenly you're more of a public figure. So that's why we call them public characters, to emphasize that this is a particular kind of character work. It can happen in more private settings. We all have a cousin who we think is just an asshole, and we do a little bit of demonization of him, or we have an aunt who's a nurse or doctor, and we think of her as kind of heroic. Different occupations work at being heroic often, the medical profession being one of them. So we have these bits and pieces of rhetoric, of character work, that I think are what we need to understand. And sometimes they get shaped into full-blown public characters, added up. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they just remain at the level of a joke at a family reunion about so-and-so's ineptitude. Although, as long as I'm free associating, sorry, but there are, I think there's a difference between some of the strengths and weaknesses dimension and the moral dimension. On the moral dimension, it's kind of all of a piece. If you're proven to be untrustworthy, immoral in one way, that tends to pollute your character, and you tend to be seen as immoral, period. If you're caught in a lie, for example, people just aren't going to trust you. Whereas on the strength dimension, well, I may not be very good with throwing a spear, but I might have magical powers that help people's health. So there are different kinds of competences and sources of strength that, if I'm shown to be a lousy marksman, I can still be a hero in other ways to some extent, although it depends on the culture. Some cultures are very specific about what the hero has to be able to do.
So one thing I was actually really impressed by reading your book is the way you you support a lot of your statements, a lot of your conclusions with examples from popular movies and popular culture. And I think it's kind of very well done in terms of you use some of those references. And indeed, because, I mean, we live in such a mediated society where a lot of references we get from popular culture. So inevitably, we judge other in terms of archetypes, right? And those archetypes, heroes and villains, come from popular movies and cartoons and other pieces of art and culture. So I think, in a sense, sometimes we do adopt this binary kind of judgment of the world, unfortunately, right?
Well, you're not as old as I am. Believe me, it gets worse. You get really tired of just not getting the popular culture references that your students make, right? It's right. Terrible. So I had to go out and study popular culture a little bit to do some of those. I really have to admit, I didn't know anything about professional wrestling, for example. But there's certain settings where the strength dimension of your reputation matters much more than your moral dimension. We see this in accounts of concentration camps, for example. Morality doesn't matter. All that matters is that you're strong. Well, in professional wrestling, it's a little bit like that. And so the villains of professional wrestling, like the boogeyman here, are much more popular than the good guys. And there are a lot more of them than there are good guys. There are good guy baby faces to some extent, but they're not as popular. And because strength and outlandish strength is what matters. And villains are almost always more entertaining than heroes. Heroes are very earnest, plodding, dependable people for the most part. Whereas the villains have always been able to crack jokes and be outlandish a little bit. But it does turn out that wrestling, pro wrestling, is full of the kind of melodrama. It is melodramatic. It is absolutely all about heroes and villains fighting each other. They're not not as many minions and victims in it, but it's a titanic clash between good and evil on the stage there, the ring. So I'm glad you like the popular culture.
James, there is time for the last question, and then maybe you can conclude by telling us about your current and future work and some of your plans. So April Harding is asking, would your conceptualization of character work shed light on how to remedy group stereotypes which encourage conflict or discourage compromise and peaceful coexistence in society? I'm thinking of Bartol's and Nett's Zengut's work on conflict-enabling narratives being widely taken up in society and making it hard to establish peaceful intergroup relations.
Well, that turns out to be the same question, because I'm hoping to write a book next on racial stereotypes in US history. And as I mentioned before, this tension between demonizing and minionizing Black Americans. I think it absolutely can work. It can work to understand the stereotyping, and so hopefully it can work to do some to remedy it. There are, I see the world in terms of dilemmas and trade-offs. So I think the dilemma there, just as there's a dilemma between whether you demonize or minionize your opponents, there's a dilemma for you as you assert yourself as basically moving from a villain category to a hero category, or from a minion or victim category into a hero category. And you see here the table of contents of the book. Chapter 9 is from victims to heroes, because we think that's really the key political process where character work really matters, that you have to assert strength. You have to stop being the weak, pitiful victim. Pity is not a good thing to apply to other human beings. Compassion, sympathy maybe, but when you pity somebody, you're making them less than human. Pity is better for animals than for children perhaps, who aren't fully capable adults yet. But to participate in politics, you have to have something of the hero about you. You have to be strong, you have to be moral, you have to be active. So all of these other categories really have to play leadership roles in politics, have to partake a little bit of the hero. So, but in doing this, heroes are strong, and strength in and of itself is frightening, right? It can be misused, even unintentionally. Bystanders can get hurt in titanic battles between good and evil. So I think strong heroes make people a little bit nervous. So you have to temper that on the moral dimension and show that you're benevolent, you're caring for others, you're not self-interested, self-centered as a hero, but you are strong enough to help. You're strong enough to protect people. So like with social movements, they have to show both that they're strong enough that everybody else has to take them seriously, which means often they have to be a bit threatening, right? They have to be, or at least have, the Black Panthers there as part of their movement. At the same time, they also have to show that they're moral and good, and you'll be comfortable with them as moral actors. So they've got to have Martin Luther King Jr. as part of their coalition in the movement. But it can fall apart pretty easily, especially when your opponents are trying to exploit that wedge between those two dimensions. So your opponents are trying to perform character assassination on you. So they might portray you as weak and ineffectual. They might portray you more often probably as evil and threatening. And you've got to show that despite your strength, despite your numbers, your competence, your dogged determination, despite that, you're good people. So it's there are a lot of choices to make, and they're not always easy ones.
James, thank you so much. It was wonderful. So I'm giving the floor to Jennifer so she can conclude our meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us. And again, thank you to our guest, James Jasper, for his insightful comments and for providing us some new ways to look at characters in political culture and in popular culture as well. Please stay safe out there. And again, follow us on Twitter at @carp_lab to learn more about our upcoming events. But thank you to the members of our audience for their great questions and engagement as well.
Thank you all for coming today.